Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Dr. Clarence Lussain discusses his book, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. He is joined by journalist Ariane Nettles. The following conversation originally took place February 23rd, 2023, and was recorded live via Zoom.
Hello and welcome to this online program of the American Writers Museum. My name is Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director for the AWM. In $20 and Change, political scientist Clarence Lussain, author of the acclaimed The Black History of the White House, writes from a basic premise. Racist historical narratives and pervasive social inequities are inextricably linked. Changing one can transform the other. Taking up the debate over the future of the $20 bill, Lussain uses the question of Harriet Tubman versus Andrew Jackson as a lens through which to view the current state of our nation's ongoing reckoning with the legacies of slavery and foundational white supremacy. He places the struggle to confront unjust social conditions in direct connection with the push to transform our public symbols, making it plain that any choice of whose life deserves to be remembered and honored is a direct reflection of whose basic rights are determined worthy of protection and whose are not. Dr. Lussain is an author, activist, scholar, and journalist. He's a professor, former chairman of Howard University's Department of Political Science, and currently the U.S. independent expert to the Council of Europe's European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. He's been a political consultant to the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation and a former commissioner for the D.C. Commission on African American Affairs. He's interviewed tonight by journalist and educator Ariane Nettles, director of audio journalism programming at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. I hope you'll join me in welcoming them both to the program.
Dr. Lussain, thank you so much for writing this amazing book and for coming here to share it with our audience. And so I'd just love to start off by asking you, how did you get the idea to discuss these two different people in parallel, and how did you approach this storytelling? Because as, of course, the synopsis that Allison read summarized, we are talking about Harriet Tubman, as well as Andrew Jackson, two people who are either on the $20 bill or being discussed. And so just two people who lived at the same time, had the same birth date, which I didn't know, but of course lived two completely different lives at the time.
Well, thank you, Ariane, for joining me in this conversation, and my thanks to the museum for inviting me and for the work that it's doing to promote a culture of critical writing and writing and thinking. So great question. So when it was announced by then Treasury Secretary Jack Lew that they would be making changes to images on the U.S. currency, the $5 bill, the $10 bill, and the $20 bill. And then specifically when it was announced that Harriet Tubman, who has long been a hero to so many of us, would be the individual that would go on the 20, then it was clear that this was an important discussion and an important moment in U.S. history. And so I felt a need to try to give it context. Who are these two individuals? And what does Harriet Tubman have to do with today? Is this just empty symbolism, or is it really meaningful at a much deeper level? So that's what initiated my beginning inquiries. And then City Lights, who I published with before, understood this. And we were able to open up the discussions about me publishing there. I didn't really actually look for any other publisher. And they gave me basically the freeway to begin to work the book. And it was a fabulous learning experience for me because there are many, many things I discovered about Harriet Tubman, not only from reading every book I could find on her and trying to separate truth from fiction, but also engaging with her family members, some of whom are here in the DC area that I've gotten close to. And so getting kind of the family side of it. And then just looking at, you know, critical scholars along the way.
Yeah. So I do want to talk about that symbolism. But just since you mentioned truth from fiction, I have found, especially, you know, with a lot of, you know, our heroes, sometimes when we're reading stories about them, there are a lot of conflicting information. Like, how did you kind of go through that truth, that fact from fiction, and figure out what was the truth, what was not the truth? Because I would imagine that there were just so many stories about her and about her life.
Okay, so just random information on the internet is generally like not that trustworthy. So you know, I compiled, you know, the different claims that were being made. How many people did she rescue? When was she born? All of that. And then went to the scholars, you know, people who had went into archives, looked at historic documents. They looked at marriage information. They looked at manumission papers. They looked at documents of when people were sold and bought. All of that was available. But you have to dig. And so that's what, you know, was just really helpful. And talking again to the family members in separating some of the fiction. And if there's any individual in world history that does not need embellishment or enhancement, it is Harriet Tubman. Just every single facet of the reality of her life, from her escape all the way until she passed in 1913. It's just amazing and fascinating, and, you know, every accolade you could possibly think, again, without having to create any fiction at all.
Amazing. So thinking a little bit about that symbolism, and a lot of this you touch on throughout the entire book. Right now, we are talking a lot about statues and street names and names of schools. And so we've been talking a whole lot about symbolisms and where these things take place and what we name stuff and what it means. And one thing I really loved about learning the book is, like, I really had no idea about a lot of that early currency and what was depicted on it. But what does money specifically kind of seem to mean to, like, American society? Like, why is it such a big deal that we're talking about specifically about the dollars, about the currency, about these bills, compared to, let's say, you know, of course, statues and everything else are important too, but why is the currency a part of this conversation?
Excellent question. So part of the way that symbols work, particularly public symbols, and it may seem a bit contradictory, but they're most impactful when they're not noticed, when they kind of blend into the background, when they become normal. So people do not look at or pay much attention to the images on the currency that they touch every single day, myself included, prior to this. You took out a dollar bill or 20, you bought coffee or whatever, you put the change in your pocket and you kind of kept rolling. So you may have noticed, you know, here and there, an image. So for example, there was a time when the Treasury Department asked every state to submit an image they would like on a coin, on the quarter. And they would do a special issue. So Washington, D.C. Submitted Ellington, Duke Ellington. And so there were quarters that were printed with Duke Ellington, and my son's name is Ellington. So, you know, that caught my attention. I have a copy of the coin. Other than that, though, you know, I kept, like everybody else, just kept rolling. And so the effectiveness was that we didn't notice, we didn't pay attention, but actually we did. And just like with the monuments, the high drama of 2020 of taking the monuments down, of changing names, is the culmination of years, if not decades, where people actually did protest, that these were not the first time that people said, you know, these are wrong, these are unrepresentative, these segregationists or Confederates should not be honored. You go all the way back to when they were created, people were, there was opposition. Now, if you were an African-American in the South, you couldn't really, in 1904, go out and protest against some Robert E. Lee statue or monument. But what research shows is that people would face these monuments when they could. They would urinate on these monuments when they could. So, and then people would write about them in the Black newspapers as, you know, these terrible, terrible, terrible public displays. It's not in my book, but I found a picture of Martin Luther King at a protest at one of these monuments in Mississippi in 1966, right? So, you know, it's a long, long history, and similar with the images on the currency. So as far back as I could research, going all the way back to the 1940s, there were women who were raising questions of why there were no women on the currency. Mm-hmm. There had been a couple of instances, short term, of Martha Washington and Pocahontas, but basically no women were on the currency in the entire history of the United States. So that didn't just start with Jack Lew. There were Black people in the 60s who were raising questions about why is only white people on the currency? And people were making songs about it and all of that. So when we get to Jack Lew, this is not a top-down decision. This is really a bottom-up. And even in that period, an organization formed called Women on the 20s, which initially wanted to have a woman replace Alexander Hamilton on the $10 bill. But then the play came about, it became really popular. So, you know, that was kind of a non-starter. And it made more sense because the 20s actually used more. So there was a big push. They did polls and surveys, queried over 600,000 people. And coming out of all of that, the consensus choice was Harriet Tubman. And then that coincided with what Jack Lew was doing with a smaller set of public discussions around the country where Harriet Tubman's name came up again. So she just sort of rose out of the crowd of history. But again, it wasn't from the top down. It really was from the bottom up, where people really, as you indicate, see symbolism as important. Now, symbolism doesn't feed people, doesn't raise the minimum wage, doesn't get you in, you know, into universities, but they're connected because how we think about history, how we think about who's important, whose story matters, shapes public policy and shapes our politics. So, you know, they are related. And I get it. There are fears of just empty symbolism and, you know, performative anti-racism. It happens all the time. But beyond that, it really is critical that there is representation. The last thing I would say is, and this isn't just a question for the U.S., everywhere in the world where there's currency, somebody made an intentional decision about whose face is going to be on that currency, whether it's going to be Nelson Mandela in South Africa, the Queen of England in Britain, Bob Marley in Jamaica. You know, somebody made a decision, and that in itself requires, or, you know, we should consider.
Yeah. And that actually, I marked a part of the book where you were talking about, like, Black support and opposition, because I remember this when it was announced and, you know, some people being really excited and then a lot of people being like, is this empty? You know, is what does this symbolism mean? And you wrote that blogger Chanel Adams wrote that African-Americans were feeling all types of ways, which I think is the perfect way to kind of describe that about the decision. She noted accurately that the responses range from debates about capitalism and representation to celebrations and cynicism. While noting the complexity of the issue, she opined, Black people literally have been and still are the currency that the United States was founded upon. So how do you think kind of all of these opposing feelings started to affect some of the decisions that came after this announcement?
So I thought it was really important to put the opposition story as part of this. And so opposition came in two ways. It came from the conservative side, which was basically, we want things to stay the way they are. And in fact, we want things to go back to the way they were when we had even more control. So that was kind of a, you know, that was, you know, unimportant, not unimportant, but, you know, dismissed as serious. But they were progressive, including Black women, women who see themselves as progressive and feminist, who really did have a sincere concern that this was going to be exploitation, that this was going to be just, let's put Harriet Tubman on and then we're done, right? And that's kind of the end of the story. So, you know, it's important that that voice be heard as well, that is part of the debate. So all of that kind of came into the mix. And, but overwhelmingly within the Black community was just massive support for Harriet Tubman, not only being on the bill and replacing Andrew Jackson on the front, but also for Andrew Jackson not being on the back. Because the original plan was that she would be on the front and he would be moved somewhere on the back. The designs are still sort of evolving, but I and many other people have been extremely vocal that that's unacceptable. You would not put out a bill and you would have Anne Frank on the front and Himmel on the back. You know, it's just not, just does not make any sense at all. So we're not, it's not clear if that will happen, that Andrew Jackson will be removed totally. But I wanted to tell not only Harriet Tubman's story and what her entire life was like, but also Andrew Jackson. And again, this work, because most people probably don't really go deeply into, you know, Andrew Jackson's life. But, you know, he was a slave trader. That's how he made, you know, his fortune. He enslaved people. He was in the military and he led military operations against indigenous people, like personally. And there were massacres that we know he involved himself in because he wrote about it. This was not a guess. He talked about what happened. There was one village where virtually every man, woman, and child was killed, except there was one child that survived that he took home to be a pet for his son, right? And he wrote a letter to his wife about it. So this is, and then when he became president, he pushed through the Indian Removal Act, which forced thousands of people to march from indigenous lands. Thousands died along the way. That eventually led to the Trail of Tears later on. So this is somebody, kind of regardless of Harriet Tubman or anybody else, who does not deserve any kind of honor at all when you look at, you know, the length of his life and kind of what he did.
Yeah. And that idea of replacement, I think, is really important because, you know, if you do like a special coin for someone, right, to honor somebody, that it doesn't change like the regular thing, you know, but you have a special edition there, or you honor people with a stamp, but that doesn't mean the other stamps aren't already existing, right? But like this idea of replacing someone with somebody else, or removing a statue and replacing it with someone else, changing a name and changing it with someone else, has been like the antithesis of these, a lot of these arguments. And so you mentioned in your book what Charles Blow calls the white extinction anxiety. Can you discuss that connection a little bit between what that anxiety is and how it relates to this particular debate?
So what we're seeing in this period, which basically has not existed before, because the white population so dominated the country, is this idea that the demographic changes that are occurring, where the Latino population, the Black population, the Asian population are growing while there is a decline in white birth rates, means that at some point that white people will no longer be not only the dominant race in the country, but maybe not even the dominant forces in power. Now, the evidence is not there at all that really the deal. There's pretty entrenched white supremacy in most areas in U.S. life, but that fear is being stoked for political purposes. And so from Fox News to Congress, we see these arguments being put forth. And what it means is then the gains that have been made by African Americans, Latino women, LGBT community, working people are all under assault because they all get placed under this label of wokeness and critical race theory and 1619 foolishness and you know, all of that becomes under assault. And we see it, you know, it's gotten a lot of attention in Florida, but Florida is the nation. And what Ron DeSantis has done on the education side, we know that, you know, half the states in the country, you know, have actually put some of these laws in place and they're trying everywhere. But on the policy side, the creation of this election police that he used, which was very fascistic, there are other governors in Texas and other places that are looking at that as models for how they can also try to address some of these kinds of issues. So it's all kind of related and interlinked. And the reason there's such a fight over these symbols, because some people do understand what they represent. Mm-hmm. And there wouldn't be such resistance if it did not challenge some of the master narratives that have been used to address and create public policy in a particular direction.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what does it feel like? Because as you mentioned, like, not a news day goes by without us having a new update or a new story or just this idea of, you know, race studies, history, kind of dominating the news cycle, actually, and to have a history book that shines light on so much of this. And, you know, because yes, your book is about two people and a certain debate, but it goes way further than just those two people, right? Like, we're using them as like a lens into these greater issues. So what does it feel like to have your book come out at such a pivotal time that I think we're going to remember for a really long time?
So I think it's important that, and I was saying this the other day, that, you know, we write books that DeSantis wants to ban. Right. So we have to be, you know, critical in the way in which we try to assess what is the particular nature of where we're at right now. I would argue, and, you know, state this in the book, that we're at a precipice and there is a creeping authoritarianism that is bulging and is not gone away, simply because there have been some setbacks, either legally or electorally. There is a very concerted push to roll back democratic gains and to establish power without democracy. And so that's what I think we're facing. And in the U.S., authoritarianism is going to be racialized. Right. That will be the linchpin. And to some degree, you can make an argument that the period from 1865, or rather after Reconstruction, after the 1870s all the way up to the 1960s, was racial authoritarianism in the South. Black people lived under different rules, different legal rights, different political rights, were subject to extrajudicial executions without punishment or accountability. That's not how white people live in the South. So the country has experienced a period where Black people nominally were citizens, have been given citizens by the 14th Amendment, but in fact did not have the rights of citizens, similar to Native Americans who did not get the right to vote till 1924. So, you know, there's a long, long history that we need to understand so we know why we're at this moment and what the dangers of this moment kind of preclude.
Yeah. And you mentioned democracy, and this talk comes at a really great time because Tuesday is actually our mayoral election day, and we're in early voting now. We have pretty good early voting turnout so far, which is sometimes difficult because the mayoral race, you know, it doesn't align with other election days. And so, you know, there's always a fear that people are like really not always encouraged to come out. And so in the book, you say that Harriet Tubman, when she's asked about like if women should vote, for example, that she says, "I suffered enough to believe it." And so what message do you think we should be sharing to encourage people, but maybe especially discourage Black voters, sometimes a lot of young Black voters, to participate in this part of democracy, maybe when they think that it doesn't mean anything, that it's not gonna help anything, but just to at least participate in something that people have really fought for, that, like Harriet Tubman said, suffered enough for to be able to get that right?
Okay, so this is such a great question. Thank you for this. Because we hadn't got a chance to talk about Harriet Tubman sort of post Civil War. And she lived in 1913. So she had decades of life after 1865. So what did she do? Part of what she did, which was really important, was to be involved in the suffrage movement. And she was unique in many ways in that she had great friends and allies in the white-dominated part of the suffrage movement, but she was also very much linked in to Black women who had suffrage organizations and Black women's organizations. And this goes from her ties to Susan B. Anthony all the way over to the daughter of Frederick Douglass. Right. And so she saw this issue as central. So for people who love Harriet Tubman and, you know, her heroics, you also got to lean into these other areas of her life. When she was on her deathbed in March of 1913, there was an upcoming huge march for the vote for women in Washington, D.C. that was happening later in March. And it had been controversial because the women who were originally organizing it had wanted Black women to march at the back of the march. And first they didn't want them to march at all. Then they said, you can march at the back of the march. But women like Ida B. Wells and women who were coming from Howard University said, we ain't doing that. We gonna march kind of where we want. So this was the context of what was going on. Harriet Tubman is at her home in Auburn. She's dying, but she's meeting with Mary Talbert, I think is her name, I remember, who was head of one of the Black women's organizations. And on her deathbed, Harriet Tubman says, tell the women to be strong, God will not forsake us. Mm-hmm. Right? So even to her last hours and days, you know, she had her target on justice and democracy and inclusiveness. So this is what, you know, I learned from Harriet Tubman is this is a lifelong commitment, right? And you push as long as you can, while you can, for these issues that you're concerned about.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. Because I think, you know, we talk a lot about people not caring. And I mean, luckily so far, we have a really great turnout, but I think we're always just trying to encourage people to participate. It is your right. it is, you know, not telling you who to vote for or what to believe, but this is your right to participate. So speaking of, you know, kind of the strength and the focus and the amazingness of Harriet Tubman, I think sometimes, not just Harriet Tubman, but I think especially her, you know, because she did such amazing feats. Sometimes when we're telling her story to, you know, especially kids and like kind of, you know, sharing more about her, we kind of talk about her as like a superhero instead of like a human hero, right? Like she was a person, she had emotions, she probably had fears and pains, she had family that she was trying to take care, like all of these human things. She just did extraordinary things, but she was not superhuman, right? She still felt stuff. And one thing I really enjoyed about this book is that I got to learn a lot more about her as a person and about, you know, not just what she did for others, but like her connection to people and how she felt about certain things, or what we can gather that she probably felt based off what she wrote and what she said later. So how did you kind of focus on that part of her when you were telling these stories in the book? Because it's just so easy to kind of just say like, she was a super, you know, it cause she did these huge things that many of us could not imagine doing ourselves. But it's like, she didn't have physically anything better than us, right? Like, I mean, she was a person, she was just amazing. So how did you do that?
So one of the things I learned that I did not know is that she had a major disability. And I think most people don't know that. I don't think in any of the movies and other things that have been done about her that, you know, that really kind of came out that strong. When she was young, maybe 11 or 12 or so, she was hit in the head with like a 2-pound steel ball or something. And she almost died. It basically, you know, busted her head open. She was bleeding. She was kind of in and out of consciousness, but she survived. But she had seizures the rest of her life. She would be in the middle of a sentence and just kind of pass out, right? And so she carried that, right? So it wasn't just that she was just kind of, you know, regular person. She had a serious disability. And you think about that, given all that she actually did, she was relatively short. She was about 5 feet tall, but she could carry people. And there's stories of her literally lifting people and carrying them when, you know, the moment called for it. So in some ways, yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, she was not a super person, whatever. But in other ways, you know, she kind of was, right?
Yes.
None of us could not do it.
I could not do it. But just the narrative that like she had a magical power type thing, where it's like, you know, that might maybe mitigate the hard work that she put in, right? Because superheroes they got superpowers, so they could just fly everywhere and do it. You know, it's like, no, she put it. That was hard. Like she did hard.
It was hard. And she would, you know, most of her escape, helping people escape, placed in the winter because it was harder to track, and it took place at night. So you got Harriet Tubman walking through valleys and rivers and all the mountains and grass and all of this in the worst possible weather and time. You know, she knew that that was the best time for, you know, the most best conditions for success. And she did it again and again and again and again.
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't imagine. And so, you know, as we think more about, I think, history, I think the average person is starting to be more, in a good way, excited about saying, you know, I want to take it upon myself to be educated about history. I'm not going to just wait for somebody to determine, right, what I get to learn, what I get to teach my children. So as we become more active participants, as just regular folks, in addition to reading books like yours, what can, you know, average folks do to kind of like do their own historical research. And you mentioned a little bit of it at the start, like making sure that you are checking all facts you find on the internet, of course, but what are some resources or what are some tips you might have for just the average person that says, I want to just learn more?
So good question. So there's good journalism and there's good scholarship. And so, you know, that's sort of the beginning. Again, there's a billion websites with all kind of crazy stuff, but there's a lot that's really credible as well. And part of the credibility is tested by, you know, how broad is and credible is the research that's being spoken about. And part of it is also in looking at the issues that we face today to recognize that there's a history to these conditions. So one of the chapters in the book is called From 1619 to COVID-19. And so as you know, a few years ago when COVID first broke out, the way in which African-Americans and Latinos were initially treated and their situations dismissed brought back all these issues of the discrimination that happens within the medical community and in the U.S. healthcare system. But there's a history to that. Going back to when Africans first came in 1619, there was never a priority on people's health. Harriet Tubman, there was no priority on her health. It was, can she get well enough to go back and work in the field? Other than that, you know, the people who owned her did not care at all. In 1918, there was another pandemic, right? That occurs in the middle of segregation in the U.S. So how Black people fared during the 1918-1919 pandemic was very much shaped by segregated hospitals, all the rest of that that existed. So none of that completely disappears. So by the time we get to 2020, a lot of these elements still remain. And so again, having that historic perspective, you know, provides a way to kind of understand and to fight against and resist the situations that arise.
Got it. Thank you. And I have just one last question for you, Dr. Lusain, before we pass it over to our audience for their amazing questions that I know that they have cooking up. But what do you want people to take away from this book when they put it down and they walk away? What do you want them to take with them?
So the book ends with another hero of mine, Fannie Lou Hamer. Mm-hmm. And Fannie Lou Hamer talks about how at a certain point, she realized every time she walked out the door, she may not be coming back, that she could die because of what she was trying to do. But she says, look, you know, I'm only 5'4". If I fall, I'm going to fall 5'4" forward. I'm not backing up. And so that's, I think, me is the message I want to get. We just can't back up, right? There's going to be push against the efforts to make this a more democratic society, to be more inclusive. That pushback is not going away. We have to have the attitude, we're not backing up. Harriet Tubman.
Thank you. What a way to end. Thank you so much for leaving us with that.
Thank you, everyone, for being here this evening. And thank you, Dr. Lusain, and thank you, Ariane.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for the great questions. And Ariane, thank you for just wonderful engagement.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful evening, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Natalie Y. Moore and J. Nicole Brooks discuss Moore's play and book, The Billboard, about a fictional Black woman's clinic in Chicago. Recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.